My name is the Reverend Kimberly Debus, and I invite you to worship with these words from Gretchen Haley. For all the promises we make, we never promise that your heart will not break, that your heart could be brave, bold, and bursting open, and be saved from the ache that sweeps over all of life. We can only hope to bolster that bravery, quiet that ache, hope to be a community that listens your story into being, becoming, whispering, it's not the end. Even now, the day breaks for us all. So let us gather, friends, with our restlessness, release, our risk, grieving the pain, praising the good, giving thanks that we dare still wade into the waters of love and longing. That we keep moving and laughing and sighing and singing, holding the silence for this time. Come, let us worship together. We are invited to light our chalices with these words from Elizabeth Harding. We Unitarian Universalists don't drink from our chalice. Instead, we use it to hold the flame. The circle of the chalice helps keep the fire small. The flame doesn't blind us, it doesn't burn us. It gives us light so we can see all the different things in the universe, even the invisible ones, because the Unitarian Universalist flame is a light of learning. The flaming chalice is a symbol of learning and love. It's our symbol, the symbol of Unitarian Universalism. Let us pray. Spirit of life, known by many names, yet by no name fully known. We gather today with hopes and dreams, and also fears and wounds. May we be reminded that all things come and go, that today's joys and today's sorrows will in time give way to those of tomorrow, and that those of us who have strength to share today ought do so while we can. And that those who are in need ought allow ourselves to receive, for tomorrow those roles might well be reversed. Spirit of life, parent of us all, help us to remember those who are not here with us today, those who need what we have found here, and those who have what we need. May we always be open to growth and change, to movement, to grace. In the name of all that is holy, and in all the holy names that have ever been uttered, and all those holy names that have not yet been imagined, let us say, blessed be, Shalom, Ashe, and Amen. Our first reading today is a story by Jessica York and Christy Olson called The Winds of Change. You never know what the wind will blow in or which way the wind blows. The wind can change directions and maybe change your life. It happened to John Murray. As a young man, Murray had excellent fortune blow his way. He had a fine education, a steady job, a loving wife, a young son. Life was good. And then suddenly everything changed. Murray's wife and their son became ill and died. He lost his job, lost all his money, and was put in jail because he couldn't pay his bills. Now, John was a very religious man, a Methodist who became a Universalist, and he had even preached about a loving God. But now he wasn't so sure what he believed. He felt his life was over. Friends urged him to go someplace where he could make a new start. So he sailed for America on a ship named the Hand in Hand. The wind blew the ship toward their destination, New York, but then a fog rolled in, and the ship ran aground in New Jersey instead. John and a few others volunteered to leave the ship, go on land, get directions and supplies. As he was walking ashore, John saw a farmhouse with a small chapel beside it. It belonged to Thomas Potter. Now Thomas greeted John, gave him food for everyone on the ship, and invited John to come back and have dinner with him that evening. Well, when John came back, Thomas showed him the chapel. He said he believed in a loving God who wanted to accept all people into heaven. John said he believed the same thing. Thomas told John he had built the chapel and was waiting for God to send him a minister. "You, John, are that minister. I have waited for you a long time." Well, John didn't want to hear this. He was not a preacher anymore, and he was determined to never preach again. Yet Thomas seemed confident that John was the universalist preacher he had waited for, and asked John to preach for him on Sunday. "I can't preach Sunday," said John, "because as soon as the wind changes, my boat will set sail and I must be on it." "Well, if the boat is not sailed by Sunday," said Thomas, "will you preach?" "Well, if I am still here on Sunday, I will preach." Now, what do you think happened? Did the wind blow? Did the hand in hand sail away, taking John with it? No wind blew. No ship sailed. And John Murray preached on Sunday morning, September 30th, 1770, in the chapel that Thomas Potter had built for him many years before. The Universalist message of the power of love was good news to many who heard. And it was good news for John. The winds of change blew yet again for him. Now, he wanted to preach more than anything, and he did for many years and helped found Universalism in America. He is one of our ancestors, of our faith home. And we as Unitarian Universalists owe a special thanks to Thomas Potter, for it was his hospitality that brought John Murray back to the pulpit. We also owe a special thanks to the wind that blew him in and would not blow him out. Our second reading is Set in Stone by Victoria Safford. In a cemetery once, an old one in New England, I found a strangely soothing epitaph. The name of the deceased and the dates had been scoured away by the wind and rain, but there was a carving of a tree with roots and branches, a classic 19th century motif. And among them the words, "She attended well and faithfully to a few good things." At first this seemed to me a little meager, a little stingy on the part of her survivors. But I wrote it down and have thought about it since, and now I can't imagine a more proud or satisfying legacy. She attended well and faithfully to a few worthy things. Every day I stand in danger of being struck by lightning and having the obituary in the local paper say, for all the world to see, "She attended frantically and ineffectually to a great many unimportant, meaningless details." How do you want your obituary to read? "He got all the dishes washed and dried before playing with his children in the evening." She balanced her checkbook with meticulous precision and never missed a day of work. Missed a lot of sunsets, missed a lot of love, missed a lot of risk, missed a lot, but her money was in order. They answered all their calls, all their email, all their voicemail, but along the way they forgot to answer the call to service and compassion and forgiveness, and first and foremost of themselves. He gave and forgave sparingly, without radical intention, without passion or conviction. She could not or would not hear the calling of her heart. How do we want to be remembered? Do we want to be remembered in a sentence? Because that's how we remember people, right? My mother was a generous woman with a sharp temper. Alandria Williams was a loving, gracious, fiery leader. We all do it. Notably, in late May of this year, the New York Times remembered the first 100,000 people who died of COVID-19 with a sentence about their lives. This is what we do. We remember our Unitarian and Universalist forebears in the same pithy manner. John Murray was shipwrecked and preached the first Universalist sermon in New Jersey. William Ellery Channing founded Unitarianism with the Baltimore Sermon. Hosea Ballou declared there's no hell and spread Universalism throughout the land. Susan B. Anthony fought for women's rights and founded the American suffrage movement. Ralph Waldo Emerson told Harvard Divinity School where they could shove it and wrote about self-reliance. Henry David Thoreau spent 2 years in an isolated cabin on Walden Pond, founded Transcendentalism, and created civil disobedience. Clara Barton founded the Red Cross. Julia Ward Howe wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic. John C. Calhoun, who we'd like to forget was a Unitarian too, was called the Cast Iron Man for his rigid defense of white Southern beliefs and practices, including slavery. And another we sometimes forget was ours, Universalist P.T. Barnum, who was considered the world's greatest showman and is widely credited with coining the phrase, "There's a sucker born every minute." One sentence. And that's just our 18th and 19th century folks. A way to remember them easily, summed up and turned into an epitaph. Mostly saints and sages, couple of scoundrels. Hearing this list, you'd think the people were not actually people, but caricatures of people. One sentence doesn't do any of them or us justice. Even the stories we tell about them, like the one we heard about John Murray, doesn't do him justice. So let's talk about Murray for a moment. The story we heard earlier is the story we know. Some of it is even true. Yes, John Murray was a Methodist from England who left the ministry when he discovered he believed in the doctrine of universal salvation, much to the dismay of his fellow Methodists. And yes, after his wife and newborn child died, Murray spent some time in a debtor's prison. His brother-in-law rescued him, paid his debts, and helped him out. Firm in his resolve to never preach again, Murray announced that he wished to pass through life unheard, unseen, unknown to all, as though I ne'er had been. In early 1770, he decided to quit his life in the old world and start fresh in the new. He boarded the brig hand in hand, which grounded on a sandbar off the coast of New Jersey. And, yes, it is true that Thomas Potter had built a chapel, but it was for a fairly constant flow of itinerant preachers. And, yes, Potter invited the reluctant Murray to preach. Now, the legend says that Potter and Murray struck a deal, and the weather played in Potter's favor. Legend also says that that sermon, delivered on September 30th of 1770, was the start of American Universalism. But what we know is that German immigrants who believed in universal salvation had already established themselves in the mid-Atlantic colonies. We know that Potter himself was connected to a group of Anabaptists who were open to universal salvation. And we know that Murray's first sermon had very little to do with universalism, as he was admittedly gun-shy. But does all of that matter? The narrative in the story describes a miracle for people who don't believe in miracles. The real miracle, if we can call it that, was a lot less headline-grabbing. The miracle was that he preached at all. And subsequently, he got his confidence back. He started preaching again and eventually established the first Universalist Church in Worcester, Mass. In 1780. This then set the stage for the more radical universalism of Hosea Ballou, who believed there was no purgatory, no waiting room, nothing that we needed to do to get ready for heaven, but that all souls go to heaven upon death. Ballou, by the way, was discredited by Murray and his followers after he preached. When the sermon that Ballou preached in Murray's church in Gloucester was concluded, Murray's wife, Judith Sargent Murray, was so aghast, she instructed a choir member to stand up and declare to the assembled, "The doctrine which has been preached here this afternoon is not the doctrine which is usually preached in this house." To his credit, Ballou's respect for Murray and his knowledge of their theological incompatibility meant that Ballou did not attempt to settle in the Boston area while Murray was alive. And that's just one part of our history. The truth is always much more complex. This saint of ours, John Murray, was a living human being with doubts and foibles and ambitions and a wife who supported him fiercely, and whose support would horrify us today. But it's not surprising that we tell stories like this instead of the less popular versions. We don't talk about Channing's disdain for universalism or his hesitancy around the abolition of slavery. We don't talk about Emerson's belligerence. We don't talk about how Thoreau spent 2 years at Walden Pond mourning the loss of his brother, and continued to go to town to get food and get his laundry done and carrying on his responsibilities to his family. We don't talk about Anthony's refusal to include women of color in her work for women's rights. And we also don't talk about P.T. Barnum's incredible philanthropy or Calhoun's insistence that the voices of all the people be heard and considered at the highest levels of government. And the reason we don't is because in order to define the social, cultural, religious thing we call Unitarian Universalism, we need to tell the stories that fit what sociologists call the cultural imaginary. Now, as I understand it, the cultural imaginary or social imaginary is a collection of stories and symbols and ideas that surround a people's concept of themselves and a particular identity. This is a remarkably common practice. We see cultural imaginaries built in Latina communities, LGBTQ communities, immigrant and refugee communities. The symbols and stories and mythos of our people, even music and literature, dances and food and media, they all contribute to the creation of a cultural imaginary. Now, to be clear, imaginary in this case doesn't mean false. The stories, music, and symbols all have roots and come authentically from the culture. However, it's these things that feed an imaginary that becomes an institution in as much as it represents the system of meanings that govern a given social structure. These imaginaries are to be understood as historical constructs defined by the interactions of a subjects in a society. These constructs then become the imagined perfect moment, the good old days. And because the power of a cultural imaginary is in how it forms societies, we who live in it get attached to them. We tell the stories to our children and forget to correct them later. And while, yes, we often tell the imagined perfect John Murray story to our children, know that that story informs us. It informs how we understand ourselves and our collective Unitarian Universalist identity as people whose message is so needed. A farmer built a chapel waiting for it, a reluctant preacher offered it, and an imagined perfect moment was born. We all know the stories, share the symbols, sing the songs, speak the lingo so well that we know what we're talking about. Those who are in or come into our Unitarian Universalist imaginary learn and catch on to those things. But cultural imaginaries have great power and great limits, as this example from an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation shows us. Now, in the genius of the Star Trek universe, there are these devices called universal translators that help species from across galaxies understand one another. And yet there are still communication problems, not with the words themselves, but with how the words are used. In an episode called Darmok, the Enterprise encounters the Tamarian people, whose words are intelligible, but whose meaning is baffling. Sentences like Darmok and Jalad across the ocean, and Mirab his sails unfurled, make up the entirety of their discourse. Now, as you can imagine, the crew of the Enterprise is baffled, and Captain Picard even more so when he's stranded on a planet with their leader. But eventually, they come to realize that the Tamarians speak exclusively in narrative imagery, a foundational part of their cultural imaginary. Their meaning is so deeply enmeshed in their narrative. As the crew of the Enterprise discover, it is analogous to our saying something like Juliet on her balcony. For us, it portrays an image of youthful romance, but if you don't know the Shakespearean play or its use in our cultural imaginary, you wouldn't understand. The joy of a cultural imaginary in our faith communities is that we can say things like light the chalice, and we know, for the most part, what it means, what it looks like, what it is. We can say waiting like Thomas Potter, and we know it's a hopeful, maybe slightly foolhardy anticipation. There are two dangers of a cultural imaginary. First, it's when it creates societal boundaries, either you're in or you're out, thus cutting people out of your exclusive club. And the second is when cultural imaginaries become the definition of how good it was then and how bad it is now. Like how we are no longer dealing with racism or sexism, and anyone saying so is trying to destroy our great society, and anyone who doesn't buy into the paradigm is ignorant or a snowflake or anti-American. Cultural imaginaries are fictions of history, because people are complex and contradictory. Cultural imaginary should be understood as a symbol of what we want to be, of who we are, but not the reality of who we are, no matter how difficult that reality might be. And that being said, cultural imaginaries can also be aspirational and informative about our collective identity. The ways we tell our stories and build them speak volumes about who we imagine we have been and who we want to be in our own culture. Why do we need these epitaphs of our Unitarian and Universalist sages, saints, and scoundrels? Well, because they help us keep rooted in our faith. They help remind us of our prophetic witness. I would even argue that we need this Unitarian Universalist imaginary, this symbolic thing, to prove that we are real, that we have real grounding, that we have real moral authority, that we are a real religion. So by now you're probably thinking, yeah, that all makes sense, but I didn't come here for a humanities lecture. What does it mean? Well, what I want you to take away most is this. The cultural imaginary, as useful as it is in forming our collective identity, is not the measure we are to live up to. When we remember that behind the story of Channing and the Baltimore Sermon, or Barton and the founding of the American Red Cross, are these complex, contradictory, sometimes terrible, sometimes wrong, and sometimes just misbehaving people, we remember that we can be as saintly or wise as they were and have the capacity to be scoundrels too. We, in our various rooms in 2020, are sages and saints and scoundrels. Sometimes more of one than the other. Sometimes all three at once in an equal measure. If we only ever see these forebearers as some unattainable goal, we've missed the point of our second source, prophetic deeds, and our first principle, inherent worth, because we are all the prophets, and we all have worth. And while some might see some actions as, well, difficult to parse, we know from our universalism that we are whole and loved and held anyway. As the character Aaron Burr sings in the musical Hamilton, love doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints. And this remains true, even if another thinks of us as a scoundrel. We have to make peace with the fact that we might be the villain in someone else's story, even if we thought we were doing the right thing. We don't get to tell them how to narrate their experience. But we also know from our covenantal faith that we get to work on making things right and better amongst ourselves. Though we've broken our vows 1,000 times, writes the Islamic mystic Rumi, come, yet again, come. When we extend the power of our cultural imaginary to not just look for the moments and the people who were perfect, but to look at the whole experience, our Unitarian Universalism grows deeper and wider. This hard work of seeing our whole selves as sages, saints, and scoundrels makes it a little easier to extend the circle of love to all of the world's sages and saints and scoundrels. May this be our call. I close with these words attributed to Rumi. Don't be satisfied with stories, how things have gone with others. Unfold your own myth without complicated explanation so everyone will understand the passage we have opened for you. Go in love, go in joy, go in peace.